You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about some of the issues facing the Supreme Court, which started its new term today.
But first, how many times have you said to yourself, well, that seemed like a good idea at the time? Probably more than a couple. According to our next guest, we're much more likely to act on impulse than reason or logic, even though we like to think of ourselves as real rational-type creatures.
But he also says that's not necessarily a bad thing. The impulsive decisions actually might have an ability to enrich our lives.
We're joined now by David Lewis. He's founder and director at Mind Lab International at the Sussex Innovation Center. He's the author of Impulse, Why We Do What We Do Without Knowing Why We Do It. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, good afternoon.
So when we talk about impulse, it usually, I think, is in a negative way. Like, I did that bad thing, it was an impulse. But it can be a good thing, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Because when we're sort of acting on impulse, or acting on autopilot, as it were, we're tapping into resources deep in our subconscious. And we may know things that in this level of the brain, which we actually don't know at a conscious level. So very often, you know, you have a gut reaction to somebody. You like them or you dislike them. At a sort of first meeting. I don't know if you remember the show MASH, television show, some years ago now, but there was a wonderful line in it, which has always stuck in my mind. There's a very unpopular officer there, I think called Henry, and he asks, why does everybody take an instant dislike to me? And the reply is, because it saves us so much time. And I think sometimes, you know, you get a feeling somebody, your skin crawls always, and you meet them, or you think, wow, this is a really nice person, I'm sure we could be friends. And this is often tapping into kind of emotional responses, which are deeply embedded in your brain, so you don't really know why you feel that way, or you go out and buy something, you don't really know at the time why you've bought it, and as you said in your introduction, well, you have to say, well, it just seemed like a good idea at the time. Sometimes it is, and sometimes, of course, it's a disaster.
Well, can you break that down for us? What is actually happening in our brains that drives these impulses?
Well, essentially, most of what we do, an awful lot of what we do, is done more or less on autopilot. Some neuroscientists have described it as our zombie brain. This is the brain which operates without conscious awareness. So that's perfectly okay. So, you know, you're commuting into work, perhaps, and while you're driving along, you're driving perfectly safely, but you're not really thinking about driving because you're an experienced motorist. So you're able to sort of think about what you're going to be doing when you get into work, or maybe if you're coming home from work, what you're going to be doing when you get back home. And so half of your brain is actually thinking about other things. Because it's a well-learned response, you're able to do it perfectly safely. And a lot of the things we can do on autopilot like this, and this saves the brain a huge amount of energy. The brain is actually a very energy-conserving organ. It operates on less power than the average household light bulb. And it does an awful lot of this because it has sort of algorithms or heuristics, rules of thumb, which it follows. And, you know, 80% of the time they'll work fine. But occasionally, of course, you do something which is just darn silly. Perhaps you have an accident or something because you weren't being what is called mindful. You really weren't attending to it. And an awful lot of accidents happen simply because we're attending to other things and not to what we're doing.
Well, this is a challenge to our self-image, isn't it? I mean, we kind of think of ourselves, or I think of myself, as this guy who thinks about things and makes conscious decisions in most things I do, but not really.
Well, no, not, I think, to the extent that we'd like to believe. We believe we act very rationally, but very often what we do is sort of do what you might call a post hoc justification. We've behaved in a certain way, and then we have to explain it to ourselves and the rest of the world. And indeed, one philosopher of science has said that, in a sense, the brain of the frontal cortex, the frontal part of the brain, is a bit like a PR, a public relations officer, trying to explain to the world why we behaved and why the company behaved in a particular way. And often this sort of PR is operating on disinformation or the wrong information or very little information. So we're trying to have to invent a narrative about why we do things. And sometimes, you know, there have been occasions. In fact, the reason I came to be interested in this subject as a neuroscientist was because way back in the 1970s, in 1971, in fact, I wasn't working as a scientist. I was actually working as a science reporter. And I was out in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, at the time of the Troubles, as they called them. And I'd arranged to meet a family who I was doing a story, basically, on how the Troubles, the fighting and the bombings, what the impact they were having on children and teenagers. And I arranged to meet a family with a 14-year-old daughter. And on my way to the meeting, it was just coming up to Christmas. It was the 4th of December. It was very cold, very miserable. I felt really depressed. So I thought on an impulse I'd go to the cinema, which I did. As a result of going to the cinema, I arrived about 20 minutes late for my appointment. And very tragically, the building in which I was going to have that meeting was blown up. And a lot of people were killed. And had I not, on an impulse, gone to the cinema, I might well, it's very likely I would have been killed as well. So that really got me thinking, you know, sometimes we do things, and it's almost like people will say, well, I had this sort of intuition that something bad was going to happen if I stepped on that aircraft or if I got into that car. And something bad does happen, and you think, well, you know, maybe I had this kind of foresight. I don't think it's that. It's just that on that occasion, you happen to have this impulse which made you do something, and because of the way things turned out, you kind of attributed some kind of, you know, sort of intervention on somebody else's behalf.
But maybe on that same day, you had tens or even hundreds of other impulses that didn't stand out because they didn't keep you from being killed in a terrorist attack.
Well, exactly so. So we remember the things where there's some very good outfit. Also, on an impulse, you might buy a lottery ticket, and you know, it wins you a fortune. You think, wow, what an amazing... But, you know, maybe hundreds of times before you made an impulsive purchase, which hadn't turned out so well. So very often, it's the way the impulse has actually turned out. Let me give you an example. I think many of your listeners maybe know of Tower Bridge, which is a very famous bridge in London, where the actual arms of the bridge raise up to let ships go underneath. And many years ago, a London bus, a big double-decker bus, if your listeners are familiar with these big buses, it was traveling across this bridge, and the bridge started to lift. And the driver had to either push his foot on the accelerator and hope he could jump this bus, which weighed several tons, over the gap, which now were yawning under his front wheels, or slam on the brakes and hope he could stop. And he decided to try and jump the bus over the gap. And he, amazingly, because this bus is very heavy and they don't go very fast, managed to do this. And he landed safely on the other side. I think one passenger broke a limb, but everybody else was saved. And you know, so for that impulse, he was rewarded and seen as a hero. But if he failed to make the jump and he'd gone into the Thames and killed everybody, you see, that would have been seen as a terrible thing to have done. So it's very often how the impulse turns out is the way we judge it as a very good or very bad impulse.
Well, you've investigated two kinds of thinking that occur in the brain called System I and System R. Could you talk about those and the relationship between the two?
Well, certainly. System I is, I've called it System I. It's called by different psychologists different things. It's been called System 1 and System 2. But I call it System I and System R because it's kind of easier to remember. System I stands for intuition, instinctive, impulsive thinking. And System R is rational and reasonable thinking. So we engage System R whenever we have, say, a maths problem to do or something where we really have to think very hard about it. And thinking is very hard work. So whenever we can, we kind of use the System I and we just essentially make a guess at it. And sometimes these guesses, as I say, can be very, very good. If you're a highly experienced professional, say you're a doctor or you're an art specialist, you may instantly have an idea what is wrong with the patient or that a piece of art you're looking at is a fake. And although you can't really immediately say why you think that, you just have this kind of gut feeling. So, you know, coming back to what I was saying earlier, these system I's can work very well on many occasions. System R engages much more energy in the brain. It's actually much more time-consuming. And we tend to restrict this to things where we really have to focus our minds on problems. And very often we come up with an answer which seems right, but we really haven't sorted through correctly. We've actually relied on System I when we should have been operating on System R and taken a more balanced, more mindful view of it.
But sometimes System R could get us into trouble. I think in your book you give the example of the Williams sisters playing tennis. If they stopped at each stroke and said, I'm going to wind my arm back and hit it at a 43-degree angle, the ball would be in the next county by the time they acted.
You're absolutely right. In fact, if you want to really, really spook your opponent when you're playing, let's say tennis, it would work with any game, I guess. You say, if somebody has served and you've missed their serve, you say, wow, that was absolutely an amazing serve. What an amazing, you are a really good player. How did you do that? You see, so now the next time they're going to serve.
How did I do that?
how did I do that? They're going to be thinking about it. And you know, if you kind of dive off a high board, if you think about how you're supposed to arrange your legs and your arms when you're heading towards the water, you're going to belly flop. So really, at that time, you have to just trust your body and trust your training and trust, you know, your instincts and do it. So sometimes trying to use system R when you should be using system I can be as bad as doing it the other way around. But it's interesting. I mean, we've looked at a lot about it kind of impulsive falling in love at first sight. And there's an interesting story because when Charles Darwin got married, when he came off the Beagle, having been on this five-year voyage around the world, and he decided he ought to get married. So he got a sheet of paper and he wrote a list. He drew a line down the middle. On one side, he wrote reasons to marry, and on the other side, he wrote reasons not to marry. And he did this kind of cost-benefit analysis.
How romantic.
It was, wasn't it?
And we might have to pick up that story after we check the news. We're talking with David Lewis about the science of impulse, and we want to hear from you. Can you remember a recent experience where you acted impulsively? Tell us what happened and how you felt about it afterwards. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll take your calls right after this check of the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at what the Supreme Court is up to as they begin their new term today.
First, we continue our discussion with David Lewis on the science of impulse. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Can you not resist the impulse to buy that candy bar, eat that treat? Do you judge people on impulse, love at first sight, or you don't believe in it? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org. David, we interrupted you mid-story about Charles Darwin acting on impulse. The story so far, he had deciding if he's going to get married or not, made the pros and cons list. Pick it up from there.
Yes, he did. That's 1836. He's just come back off the Beagle. He decides he ought to get married, but he's not sure, so he makes this list. On one side of the paper, he writes reasons for marrying. On the other side, he writes reasons for not marrying. He sort of puts down all the pluses and all the, as he sees it, all the minuses. He adds them all up, and he decides he should get married. And in fact, at the bottom of the list, he wrote QED, marry, marry, marry. And he got married, and he remained married for the rest of his life, for over 30 years. It was a very happy marriage, very fruitful marriage, lots of children. And so here he clearly used what we called before System R, this reasoned, rational, scientific approach, which many people, I think, would think was pretty unromantic. But let's look at another famous person, Bertrand Russell. Now, Bertrand Russell fell in love when he was 17. He fell in love with a 23-year-old. He waited until he was of age, which in those days would have been 21. He then proposed to her, and they got married. But they didn't stay married. In fact, Russell, in the course of his life, I went through, had four wives. I knew Russell. I used to stay sometimes at his house in Wales, which was a very interesting experience. And his last wife, absolutely lovely lady, called Edith. They were a very loving couple. But nonetheless, he was very much more of a system I, a kind of guy. He fell in love at first sight, and unfortunately, he fell out of love just as easily.
Yeah, but when Charles Darwin or anyone sits down and makes their lists and does their research, aren't we often just confirming our gut feeling in the first place?
Well, you know, I think that's a very interesting supposition, because I think it's often true. Somebody said to me, if you want to know how to make a decision, toss a coin. Not that you should actually rely on how the coin falls, but as the coin is sort of turning in space, you'll know which way you want it to land, because that's actually kind of your gut feeling is, well, I want to do this or I don't want to do this. So as the coin is spinning, you think, well, I hope it lands heads, because if it lands heads, I'm going to do it or I'm not going to do it. So I think you're right. Very often we kind of intellectualize. We say, wow, That's the reason I did it. But there seems to be a part of the brain, a part of the brain called the frontal cortex, the part of the brain at the front or the front of the head, just above the eyes, which acts as a kind of a monitor, which imposes self-control. It kind of stops us doing our impulse. It sort of says, well, hang on a second there. Just think about it before you act. And in children, this is the last one of the last parts of the brain to develop, which is why young people, teenagers especially, are very prone to risk-taking. They're very impulsive. They don't really think through their actions. It's simply because their brains are still developing, and they continue to develop up to about the age of early 20s in some cases. But if you suffer any damage to that part of the brain, the frontal cortex, it can make you very much more impulsive, very much less sort of responsible. There's a famous case in America. It goes back to the 19th century. Any of your listeners who have done psychology will have certainly have come across his case, because it's curious, because this man was a 19th century railroad worker, a man called Phineas Gage, and his job was to blow up rocks. And the way they did this was to drill a hole in the rock. They then filled it with explosive. He then used a long steel pole, a tamping rod, to stamp it down, to stamp the explosive down, having put sand on the explosive first. And then they would light the fuse and stand back, and the rock would blow up, and they could proceed with the railway. He was building railways. Now, on one occasion, he got careless, and he actually pushed the rod into the hole on top of the explosive before they put any sand there. And there was an explosion, and this rod then traveled up through his head. It went in under his left eye and came out of the top of his head and landed many yards away, and it destroyed most of the front parts of his brain. But amazingly, in those days, because they had no anesthetic, they had no anesthesia, they had no painkillers, no analgesia, he survived. But everybody said that the Gage who survived with part of his brain missing was not the Gage they'd known. And from being a very responsible, hardworking, diligent sort of guy, he'd become much more impulsive, much less responsible. He changed jobs frequently. And in fact, after his death, his skull was dug up and is actually, I think, in the Yale Museum, and you can see it alongside this tamping rod. But it's a very, very famous case in neuroscience, because it demonstrates for the first time that certain parts of the brain seem to have a specific function, a localization of function within the brain.
Well, it sounds like even as you talked about Charles Darwin's very rational approach to deciding whether to get married, that even at the basis of this, there's a natural propensity to be impulsive. Is this something that can be changed, or is it just something that is natural to us?
I think there's probably a genetic component. I think some people are much more sort of prone to impulsivity. Actually, any of your male listeners might want to try this. It's a test which is actually quite accurate. If you measure your second digit and your fourth digit, so it's called the 2D4D test. Mm-hmm. If you take the ratio of the length of your second digit of your dominant hand, so if you're right-handed, that would be your right hand, and so the second digit is the one next to the thumb, and the fourth digit is for the fourth digit, and you compare the ratio. If it's less than one, it's likely that you're more of a risk taker. Huh. You're more likely to be a risk taker, more likely to act impulsively, and this is because it means that when you were in the womb, you received more testosterone. And this is a measure. It affects both the way your brain works, but it also affects, rather strangely, the length of your digits. But it only works with men.
Interesting.
Why only men?
It's the testosterone thing.
Doesn't work with women. It has no effect on women. But this 2D4D ratio less than one is one of the indications that people are likely to be risk takers. And also, levels of testosterone have an enormous impact on how impulsive people are. A study carried out by two researchers at Cambridge University looked at the amount of testosterone in the bloodstream of high-risk, high-frequency traders in London, and they found that on the days when they were taking very big risks, you know, sort of gambling millions of dollars or millions of pounds, their levels of testosterone were much higher. So again, there does seem to be a hormonal factor in how risk-taking people are, in a sense, how impulsive they are.
Well, let's get a call from a possibly impulsive listener. We've got Dana on the line in Montello. Dana, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I have an impulsive thing, I guess. Back in 98, I went backpacking around Europe alone. And about 6 months before I left for my trip, I met this gentleman in a bar who told me he liked my girlfriend, and it just happened to be anybody that liked her never liked me and vice versa. So I really believed he liked her. Well, apparently it was all a ploy. He really just wanted to talk to me.
Uh-huh.
Well, before I left for Europe, I told him, hey, I'm leaving for Europe in, you know, a couple weeks here. And knowing he had been stationed in Europe, you know, I thought he'd be interested to talk to me about it, places where to go and et cetera. And he said, oh, you know, that's too bad that you're leaving because I always wanted to ask you out. And I was, like, just thrown back, and we went out for about 2 weeks, and it was this real hard decision to actually go and stay together and not go to Europe and or get on the plane and go. And he said, you'd resent me if I made you stay. So, well, the two-week relationship ended. And it's not my way of, you know, getting, you know, falling in love and, you know, fantasizing that every man I ever met I'm going to marry. So it wasn't that big of a deal, you know, to date, you date. Well, I get to Europe. I travel around for about 6 months, and everything I would write in my little journal. And I'd start in my journal, you know, I miss my mom, I miss my dad, I miss, you know, McDonald's hamburgers, I miss, you know, something about America. And just by impulse or whatever, I wrote, I miss Leonard, my now husband. And it threw me. I'm like, Leonard, really? I mean, out of all of the men I dated, he was a very short person, you know, very short
Dana,
period of time.
Dana, we do have to wrap this up real quick. Can you tell us what happened?
And so I came back from Europe, and just by impulse, I looked him up, and 3 months later, we got married.
And you're still married?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm both married 6 years this January.
Well, congratulations, Dana. So, a happy ending, excuse me, to an impulse story there.
Indeed, absolutely.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about, you know, what's behind our impulses.
My pleasure. Always a delight.
David Lewis is the founder and director at MindLab International at the Sussex Innovation Center and author of Impulse, Why We Do What We Do Without Knowing Why We Do It.